My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. If you can't hear me in the back, please raise your hand or something. Thank you. I want to thank Clancy for inviting me to speak here tonight. He called me a year or so ago and said he'd like to have me speak here for this Friday evening opening meeting of the 2004 Desert Powwow. I said, don't you think we're a bit presumptuous, Clancy, thinking that you and I will be alive in 2004? He said, just show up at the damn meeting. It's an honor and a privilege and a hell of an inconvenience to be here. Before I forget it, I want to thank Shirali Jay for the wonderful work that she has done here. It's been a real pleasure to watch Shirali work. Everything has been done with careful attention, meticulous attention to detail, including this stool. Can you believe that? And I want to thank Shirali for that. First time I got drunk, I was about 13 years old. I had gone to visit my cousin in town. We lived on a crappy little farm north of Sioux City, Iowa. And when I say crappy, I mean 40 acres of yellow clay hills you couldn't raise a dust storm on. And it was around Christmas time, and we'd been nibbling on peanuts and candy all day long, and we found a quart of slow gin about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drank that quart of slow gin on top of a half a pound of Spanish peanuts and restuccoed my cousin's house. Twenty-five years later, I was up in Ojai, California, taking a little nap in front of my open refrigerator door about 2:30 in the morning, where I had my dinner. I had a cold chicken and a quart of Mogan David wine, cold Mogan David wine, and I was throwing up straight up in the air and trying to dodge the wine mist that was drifting down. See, there's a few other wine mist dodgers here. I like to tell those two stories at breakfast meetings where there's a lot of newcomers. Well, those are the two bookends of my drinking life. They were separated by 25 years. And a couple of things happened in between there that I'll tell you about, and I won't go drunk by drunk through the whole 25 years. But, you know, I went to school, and I did badly in school. I graduated from high school 169th from class of 175 from the bottom. The dean of discipline told me, McNally, if your diploma has a signature on it, it'll be a miracle. That's actually what he said. And so I bummed around for a while after I got out of high school, and I got polio in 1952 in an epidemic we had near Sioux City. A lot of people died in that epidemic. I spent 105 days in a hospital and left there unable to walk 105 days later. And my buddies brought beer to my house, and I began drinking beer and anything else I could get my hands on, and I soon acquired a very fine taste for alcohol. And so I drank as often as I could, which wasn't all that often in the beginning. I got a job operating heavy earth-moving equipment in Illinois, and exactly the right thing to do if you can't walk around, you know. I had a hard time with authority figures. I guess it must be congenital with me, but I had a hell of a time with authority people. And one of my bosses told me to go down and clean out this farm dam that was filling up with mud, with silt from the rain. And the way he said it seemed a little disrespectful. So I took that tractor down in the farm dam and chomped on one brake and one steering clutch and turned it around and around and around until you could just see the smokestack coming out of the water. Well, that was my last day doing that kind of work. And a guy from the Iowa Vocational Rehabilitation came to my house and said, we'd like to send you to college. And I goes, what the hell would you want to send me to college for? I just barely got out of high school. And he said, well, we're thinking about paying your tuition to go to college. And I said, I don't think I want your charity. He said, we're not talking about charity. We're talking about making you into a taxpayer. It was an odd way to approach it, so I thought, okay, I'll go be a taxpayer. So I went down to this little college in eastern Iowa and signed up and started studying political science. And that was interesting to me. It was controversial and had a lot of adrenaline in it, and it was good for me. And I stayed there for 3 years, and at the end of the 3 years, the political science head of the department said to me, McNally, you got a kind of a weird linear way of thinking. You ought to consider studying law. So I went over to Omaha, Nebraska, to the Creighton University, and enrolled in their law school after 3 years of college. And I really shaped up my life. I stopped drinking and stopped going to the bars, studied the cases, recited the cases, put on a suit and tie, and really shaped up for about 4 weeks. And the first grades came out, and they were not A's. And if you have a little touch of perfectionism, as I do, we call ourselves perfectionists with chili on our ties. If you have a little touch of perfectionism, I said, screw it. They don't recognize talent when they see it. I'm out of here. So I went back to the bars, and in less than a year of in and out of school, I literally drank my way out of that school. They didn't want to even talk to me anymore. And I bummed around New York for a while and enrolled in the University of South Dakota School of Law in the fall. And that's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. It's University of South Dakota is at the town of Vermilion. And Vermilion is a metropolis of at least 5,000 people. And it's not a Big Ten school, I'll tell you that for sure. But I got a law degree from there in 1961 and got licensed to practice in Iowa and started practicing in an old real estate firm in Sioux City, examining abstracts of title to real property. And along with watching corn grow, that's the dullest job in the world. What you do is you examine the history of this piece of dirt going back to the original government patent, which is when we stole it from the Indians. And you bring your search forward through all of the documents that are filed, and sometimes they're 6 inches thick. And at the end of this ordeal, you render an opinion about who you believe owns the property. Who gives a damn? I didn't care who owned the property. I was drinking in the bars by this time every night. And I was a little nervous in the daytime, and I was in a hurry to get back to the bar, and I didn't give a damn who owned the property. Well, a guy I knew, Don O'Brien, who was a local politician, had been appointed U.S. District Attorney by John Kennedy. By now it's 62. And he'd call me on the phone and said, how'd you like to be a federal prosecutor? I said, yeah, when do I start? He said, well, you got to go through a little investigation and stuff. And he got me appointed by Robert Kennedy to be Assistant Federal District Attorney for that district. I was like 28 years old. And I had credentials, and I had a U.S. Justice Department credentials, and I was a big shot, by my own estimation. And but the only thing that changed about my life was now I'm falling off better bar stools. I was drinking uptown in the upholstered bars where, you sit on a nice upholstered stool, and when you fall off at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're on a nice upholstered step. You're not hitting that brass rail like we used to do. And that's the only thing that changed about my life. Well, I stayed there a few years, and John Kennedy was assassinated, and the political scene changed a lot. And so I left the government and decided to run for the state legislature. I got married in 1964 in June, announced that I was running for the state senate, got on the ballot, campaigned in the bars as God intended us to do. And I had not the slightest expectation of winning that election. I mean, I was a Democrat at that time. I don't know what the hell I am now. But I was a Democrat at that time, and it was a very strongly Republican district. Well, some of you are old enough to remember, I see a few white hairs in here, remember that Goldwater was running at the top of the Republican ticket and Lyndon Johnson was running at the top of the Democratic ticket in 1964. And Lyndon Johnson won by a huge landslide, carrying himself and a lot of other incompetents into office, including me. So I woke up the day after election, hungover and sick as usual, and looked in the paper, and sure enough, I'd been elected to the state legislature. So I got my pregnant wife together, and we moved down to Des Moines. I got to tell you that one of our brethren who ran in that election was running for the state House of Representatives. Iowa has a House of Representatives like California has an assembly. And he campaigned from one bar. He didn't leave this one bar. And when he was elected in the landslide, he was heard to remark, "Now that I'm a representative, shall I report to Des Moines or Washington, D.C.?" He did not know if he was a state or a federal representative. And that situation hasn't changed a damn bit, I can tell you that. Not a bit. But that's another pitch for another day. So we moved to Des Moines, and I set up headquarters at the Savory Hotel Bar. And that's where all the lobbyists hung out, and that's where all the high-level government business was being conducted, which is bullshit. That's where everybody was getting drunk. And that's where I went to get drunk every night. And, you know, my wife wasn't too terribly happy about the fact that I was out late every night doing high-level government business. And she said so. And after a few months of that, a guy from my hometown showed up, a guy named Dick S. And Dick was a notorious outlaw drunk up in Sioux City, and I knew him, you know, casually. And he shows up in my office, and he's got a sheaf of these yellow questionnaires put out by John Hopkins Hospital, the 20 questions that we use in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes. And he said to me, "You know, if you ever run into anybody down here that you think might have a drinking problem, give them one of these questionnaires." And, you know, he handed me this whole pile, and I thought he was talking about me. And I looked at the bottom, you know, we might be drunk, but we're not stupid. I looked at the bottom first, and it said, "If you can answer any three of these questions yes, you are definitely an alcoholic." So I looked at the bottom, and I wasn't ready to be definitely an alcoholic, so I could answer one of them. You know, drinking was making my home life a little unhappy. If I'd been honest at all, I could have answered all 20 of them. But I got him out of my office because he made me very nervous. And I put those 20 questions in the back of a New Testament Bible where they would avoid any further scrutiny. And I went on about the business of drinking. I went on about the business of drinking. And you know, it got worse. It kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I, you know, I don't have any serious regrets about my conduct in those days. I was in drunk enough Savory Hotel Bar every night. That was about all I was doing. And I wasn't selling my vote, and I wasn't, you know, taking bribes or any of that kind of stuff. But I saw a lot of that done, and I got a real good inside view of state legislative politics. But when it came time to announce to run again for election, I decided not to run again. I was developing by now a certain alcoholic paranoia that said, they're going to find out about you. And there really wasn't anything to find out except that I had this mindset that they're going to find out about me. So I didn't run again. Instead, I took a job as a lobbyist. And that's a better job than being a legislator for a party guy, a drunk, because my job was to party every day and get paid pretty well for it, and have a liberal expense account to pay the bills. And so I partied, and I tried to influence legislation to favor the people I was working for. And when the barmaids and the bartenders and everybody went home, I was still out there partying. And I did that day in and day in and day out. And I was beginning now to have certain little physical signs of alcoholism. I was beginning to see things out of the corner of my eye. When you turn really fast, they're gone. You never, ever can quite catch them. And some people are unkind enough to call those visual hallucinations. I didn't hear any little voices, but I saw these little things out of the corner of my eye. And I was having blackouts and grayouts, and I'd drive home, and I wouldn't have a clue about who drove me home. So I went to my local doctor, and he said, "Wow, your metabolism is really screwed up." Well, dinner, in my usual dinner, was a hard-boiled egg and a pepperoni out of one of those dirty bottles on the bar. That was my dinner. And, you know, and you drink a quart of whiskey every day and you eat a pepperoni and a hard-boiled egg, it's bound to do something for your metabolism. So they didn't know what was going on, and I wasn't telling them the truth, of course. And so they sent me up to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, a very fine medical institution. And they asked me some really dumb questions up there, like, "Do you drink a lot?" And I gave them an even dumber answer, like, "I have an occasional social drink." Now, they weren't hip enough in those days to ask the simple cross-examination questions like, "How close together are those occasions and how big is the drink on each occasion?" They weren't particularly interested in that, I don't think. So they just wrote down, you know, occasional social drink. And when it came time for the diagnosis, I said, "What do you think's wrong with me? You know, why am I my blood sugar all screwed up and my metabolism's way off?" And I had cholesterol routinely of 450. Yeah, that was just ordinary, you know. And the doctor looked at me sagely and said, "We think you have executive stress syndrome." And sounded okay, though, because there was nothing in there about alcohol or the abstaining from alcohol. So I said, "What do you do about executive stress syndrome?" He said, "Well, we have these blue tablets. We have some blue tablets that we give you, 10 milligram Valium." So I went back to Des Moines and drank a quart of whiskey and took a whole bunch of those 10 milligram Valium and got very serene. I got real serene to the point where I couldn't hit my rear end with either hand some days. And it was not going well. It was going downhill. It was going downhill. So on July 3rd of 1968, my wife and by this time 3-year-old daughter and I are traveling on Interstate 80 from Omaha to Des Moines in our old station wagon when a lady rear-ended us doing about 95 miles an hour. Booted us off a high embankment, rolled us over 7 times, and my wife was thrown out of the vehicle and killed that day on the freeway. And my daughter and I rolled up on fire in the bottom of a creek bed. My daughter was not harmed. I had a bunch of broken bones. I had a broken shoulder and some broken ribs and on, but I wasn't seriously hurt. And spent 6 days in the hospital, got out. Only knew one way to cope with tragedy in my life. That's to get drunk. I knew of no other way to deal with any hard times in my life, so I got drunk. I stayed drunk for 60 days, maybe. I don't know. I wasn't counting. But, you know, it's very difficult to stay drunk all the time. I've tried it. It's very, very hard to stay drunk. Your body will ultimately reject alcohol, sometimes spectacularly from both ends. And my body rejected alcohol after 60 days, and I sobered up, in quotes. You know, I wasn't really sober, but I was free of alcohol to some extent. And I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, sober, and I had one of those wonderful alcoholic insights. You should be very careful when you get one of these. My alcoholic insight said to me, "You know, every problem you've ever had in your life has occurred in Iowa." And I see there's some other keen alcoholic thinkers here. So the answer was obvious: get the hell out of Iowa. I got my elderly mother put together on the belief that it was going to be better in California. You know, it would be better in California. I didn't know anybody in California. I didn't know a soul in California. But we moved out here to Ojai, California, northeast of Ventura, about 15 miles. And I found the Firebird Tavern up there. Within 24 hours, I was in the Firebird Tavern having some cold beer. I spent 3 years sipping their cold beer up there and other alcoholic beverages, and it wasn't going well. I somehow managed to get by the California bar exam, and I got licensed out here, and I got practicing in an old wooden frame house down in Ventura. And being the new kid on the block, they weren't going to give me the big probate cases and the fancy real estate cases and all that stuff. So I did a lot of criminal defense work. I'd had a lot of experience with criminal defense work as a federal prosecutor and as a federal defense lawyer back in the Midwest. So it was a kind of a natural place for me, and I had some pretty good luck defending people, even though I was drinking every night in the bars. A lot of people in the bars have legal problems, as you might know. And I had a lot of clients. I never got any money from them, but I had a lot of clients. And I was doing that. I was cross-examining police officers all day long, trying to make them look like the Keystone of Cops, you know. And some people in here aren't old enough to know who the Keystone Cops were, I guess. So I tried to humiliate them so as to discredit them and get my clients out the door, get them out of trouble. And so I was afraid at night to go to the usual downtown haunts and drink a lot of booze, because if I drove up to Ojai on that 15-mile road with a 2.6 blood alcohol, which is where I usually drove, the CHP might pick me up doing that, and I was scared that they wouldn't treat me real well if they did. So I would sneak back to my office and go to sleep under my desk. And I had a big old table about the size of this table here, and I would crawl under that table and go to sleep, fully clothed, wake up in the morning. You know, your mouth feels like the bottom of a bird cage. You're fully clothed, sweaty, tie is all wrinkled up. And my partner came in and leaned down, you know, "Hi, Jim. How you doing?" "Hi, I'm fine." And it was going downhill. It was really going downhill. And I had tried a lot of different things to find out what the hell was wrong with me. I'd been to psychiatrists. I'd been to a psychiatrist. I drove all the way to Beverly Hills to visit this wonderful guy, and he was a good psychiatrist, but I was drinking, and he wanted to talk about dreams, and I wasn't dreaming. If I did dream, I didn't remember the dreams. But you're not going to drive 75 miles and pay $50 an hour and just sit there like a dummy and say, "I don't dream." So I made up the dreams on the way down to the, you know, I mean, if that isn't sick, I'll give you a dollar. I'm giving this guy false symptoms, and he's giving me a false diagnosis, but he picked up on it pretty quickly and decided that I was too sick to be susceptible for psychiatric treatment, and he fired me. He said, "I don't think you're ready for psychiatry," you know, and so I gave that up. And I tried reading inspirational books. I tried the Psycho-Cybernetics and other popular self-help books. I read all those damn books, and they were like Chinese food for me. You know, an hour later, you're hungry again. And nothing worked for me at all. Nothing would even come close to describing what was going on. And then one day I crawled out from under my desk and I picked up the Ventura paper, and there's a story in there about the Serra Retreat House in Malibu, which had burned down in the fire in 1970. And the article said that they were giving these spiritual retreats and that you could come if you called a certain number and arranged to come in. So I called this number, and a nice woman answered the phone and said, "Yeah, we're having these retreats. The buildings are going back up, and we're back in business, and we're going to give these retreats. And you could even come this weekend if you wanted to." "Oh, yes, the one this weekend is for alcoholics." There was a long silence on my end of the phone, and I finally said, "I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll come anyway. You know, we got to hedge our bets. You don't want to, you know, we used to say to our clients, there aren't any deaf and dumb people in jail. You just don't say anything if you're asked any questions. If the man asks you if you had anything to do with stealing a church steeple and it's sticking out of your back pocket, I'll clean that up a little bit, you say to the man, 'I don't know nothing about no church steeples.'" So I wasn't used to copping to anything. In fact, I used to think that a friend is a future enemy with evidence. So, So I drove down to this retreat, and I was very nervous because I hadn't had a drink all day. It was Friday, and I was going down there. It started on Friday night, and there were 25 or 30 guys there, all clear of eye and steady of hand, as Jimmy Ryan used to say. And I didn't see any alcoholics, because I knew what alcoholics looked like. I knew what I represented, a hell of a lot of alcoholics, and they were, you know, bleary-eyed, and they had the wiring showing in their faces, and they were tough-looking people, and they were cutting on each other and shooting at each other and running over doctors in the crosswalk and all kinds of stuff, you know, that we do. But these guys were all smiling and happy and seemed like they were reasonably sane, which was new to me. And they were awful friendly, which put me off some, but they invited me to stay, and I stayed. Saturday night, they had a round table discussion meeting, a big round table discussion meeting, and I didn't want to go to it. I mean, alcoholics go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but they had prevailed upon me, and I finally said, okay, I'll go as an observer. So I observed, and they're all going around the table sharing their stories about drinking and sobriety and, you know, crashing cars and leaving the country and coming back to the country and getting married and divorced and all the stuff that we do, falling downstairs and falling upstairs. And when it came my turn, I said, my name is Jim, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't believe it. But see, that wasn't anything new for me. I'd said a whole bunch of things in my life I didn't believe. You know, I was a criminal defense lawyer, for God's sake, you know. You don't think we're telling those judges and those juries the whole truth all the time, do you? And so these old-timers cornered me after the meeting, and the meeting was over about 10 o'clock, and they kept me up until 2 in the morning yakking about their particular stories, and I wanted to tell my story, but they didn't give a damn about my story. They wanted to tell their own stories. At 2 o'clock, they disappeared. Took me a long time to figure out that they figured the bars were still open until 2 o'clock in the morning down in Malibu, and they were going to keep me up until the bars closed. But one of them said, you know, I think you're going to drink some more, but we have screwed it up so you won't enjoy it anymore. Another guy wasn't nearly as straightforward. He said, look, if you want to be sober, go back to Ventura and find somebody in AA and get connected with them and go to meetings. Go to the AA meetings and see if there's something there that fits you. So I went back to Ventura and I got drunk. But the first guy was right. And then after I got sick enough again, I called a guy named Bud and told Bud that I thought I might have the beginning of a little tiny drinking problem. Bud said, we know. We know you do. I thought it was a secret. So he said, if you want to be sober, I suggest you go to the AA meetings, and you could start today at the Norman and Cooper Manor in Oxnard. I thought, today? That seems a little soon, don't you think, Bud? He said, no, I think you ought to go today, because you're going to drink today, aren't you? And I said, yeah, probably. He said, I think you ought to go to the meeting today. So I drove over to Oxnard in my alcoholic Cadillac, dinged up, you know, and my bullshit lawyer's three-piece suit, you know, tattered and shiny, and went to the Norman and Cooper Manor, which was a low-bottom drying-out place. This was a place people went to die of alcoholism, and I'd never heard of it before. Naturally, you know, the big shots in town don't go to the Norman and Cooper Manor for lunch. So I show up there, and there's 12 or 13 old guys as old as I am now, sitting around a scarred table with a bare light bulb hanging down in the middle. And they got a big book in front of them. And they all got their blue terry cloth robes and paper shoes. And the head leper is head leper is reading from the big book, and he's saying, if you want what we have... I was too dishonest to be honest with them, so I said to myself, if I don't get out of here in a minute, I might get what he has. So I left, and I went back to Bud, and I said, Bud, Jesus, these people are rowing with one oar in the water. Why am I going to see these drunks? And he said something that saved my life. It was not intended to be kind. he said, they got meetings for big shots in Beverly Hills. And I thought for a minute, and I thought, you know, that's about right. So I drove 75 miles to Beverly Hills. And I'm sure I must have passed at least 50 or 100 perfectly good AA meetings on the way down there. And I started going to the Friday night meeting at Rodeo Drive Group, the Rodeo Drive Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've later learned that they couldn't pronounce rodeo, so they called it the Rodeo Drive Group. And it was fine. They had these Rolls Royces and these Maseratis out in front and beautiful women in the meetings, and I thought, they've got what I want and we'll go to any length to get. On September 10 of 1971, there was a gorgeous woman speaking for 10 minutes at the podium, and I took a look at her and decided that she had what I wanted and would go into any length to get. So I thought, you know, I was still drinking. I didn't have anything to lose. I was, you know, powered by alcohol. I wasn't drinking that day, but I was still drinking. So I asked her out to dinner, and her 10-year-old daughter was with her, and it was her natal birthday. And people said, it's not a good idea to get emotionally involved in the first year of your recovery. I didn't have to worry about that because I wasn't in the first year of my recovery. So we started dating, and in 87 days after we met, we were married. It's not really recommended, I can assure you, in fellowship. But Mary had two children, Doug and Ellen. I had this little girl, Mary Margaret, and we put those two families together in Ojai, and they didn't fit too well. It was a little crazy because I was still drinking, and marriage was not a cure for alcoholism. It didn't even slow it down a bit. And so I kept drinking. Mary would go to her meetings. I'd go to the bar. And this went in and out. I'd get 10 days. I'd get 20 days. I'd get 5 days. And I got to the point where I'd heard the great speakers. I heard Chuck Chamberlain. I heard Clancy. I heard Norm Alpe. I heard Jack Bailey. I heard a lot of these wonderful speakers, and I admired them tremendously. But I knew for sure, after 7 months of chipping around with AA, that I was never going to be sober. I came to believe, to my innermost self, that I was never, ever going to be sober. And when I really got to believe that and accept it, that was my first step. I walked into the Firebird one night, no intention of that being my last drink of alcohol, not the slightest thought of it. Had a bottle of Coors, had a second bottle, drank the first glass out of the second bottle, shoved the second half of that second bottle back on the bar and walked out of the place, never to have another drink of alcohol to this day. That was March 30th, 1972, 32 years ago. Now, I had no intention of that being my last drink. I hadn't the slightest intention. And I look back in retrospect and I say, what happened? What happened was that I had taken the first step by admitting that I was totally and completely powerless to do anything about my alcoholism. You know, if you're in here and you can't stop drinking, guess what? That's our problem. So, you know, after I had that last drink, my life just sort of drifted off into a sea of tranquility, and and we lived happily ever after. Lying is the last thing to go, they say, you know. I got sober and I realized that my life was a goddamn mess. It was an absolute mess. I owed a lot of money. I was in serious trouble in a lot of departments, and I was not feeling well at all. I was sick as a dog, and you know, that's just the beginning of the wonderful program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a guy came around, Bud was kind of my first sponsor, but another guy came around and appointed himself my sponsor. He was a 225-pound prize fighter, David H., been a member of the Pacific Group. And he said, I'm going to be your sponsor. I said, okay, sounds good to me. So I went through the steps, with David. We used to run down to L.A. three nights a week, you know, and I'm working every day, and I didn't realize for years that David was sleeping until noon. And I'm going down there, and I'm getting back at 2 or 3 in the morning, getting up at 7, going to work. But that was okay. I needed to do that. I needed that frenetic, kind of crazy activity to stay away from that first drink. Things very, very slowly began to get better. Very, very slowly. If I've got anything to say here today at all, it's that my recovery has been really, really slow. Mary and I started going to a lot more meetings, and I started sharing in meetings a little bit and being asked to speak, my two-step program, my first and my 12-step. You know, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and I'd tell anybody about that wanted to hear it. Not too many people wanted to hear it. And things very, very slowly started getting better. We started traveling, going out of town, talking, and getting busy sponsoring people. We had a lot of 12-step calls, a lot of wet drunks in those days. This was before there were very many of these drying out places, and we used to do an awful lot of 12-step work. And remember one night, Mary and I went and picked up this drunken guy in Casita Springs, and he was hallucinating. And he, on the way to the drying out place where we were taking him, he said, "Look, there's angels coming out of those. There are green angels coming out of those lights, the street lights." He said, yeah, just take it easy. We'll be there pretty soon. And we got him there and dropped him off. And we're driving back, and Mary says, "You know, there are green angels coming out of those." The tinting on the top of the windshield, when you looked at through that tinting, it looked a little bit like green angels were coming out of the streetlights. And we were sober. But we had every kind of experience you can have. We buried a guy. That very guy died because he couldn't stay out of controversy. He got in a fight with the guy that owned the drying out place, went out in his car and drank a quart of booze, died of an esophageal hemorrhage in his car. We went to his funeral. It was a county pauper funeral. He was buried in Potter's Field up in Santa Paula. Little cardboard casket. There were three of us there, Mary and I and the minister that was hired by the county to give the last services. Guy had run out of everything, including his life. But life started getting better. I resisted feeling better. I don't know if you can relate to that, but I started actually feeling physically better and better, and I pulled back from it because I knew how to walk around with a headache and diarrhea for 25 years. I didn't know how to feel good, and I resisted it. And people would say things that were helpful. I remember going up in Los Padres Forest on weekends and throwing a sleeping bag up on a picnic table. I was tired. I had been going day and night for 25 years, and I was tired. And I'd go up there and I'd sleep all day Saturday on a picnic table. And very slowly, I started coming back to some form of humanity. And then we got overly busy, because anything worth doing is worth overdoing. And we started sponsoring a bunch of people and talking all over hell, and we got very active in AA. And time went by, 10 years went by. And one day I saw a thing in the paper about there was a vacancy on the Superior Court in Ventura County. And they were looking for applications to replace the judge. And I had noticed for years that the only guy in the courtroom, I'd spent 25 years in court trying cases of all kinds all over the country. And the one thing I was sure of, the guy sitting there in the black robe wasn't doing much work. Once in a while he'd say overruled, you know, or sustained, you know, motion denied, often motion denied. And so I thought, well, what the hell? I think I'll try out for that job. So I sent in a 33-page questionnaire they sent down, and they had a lot of hard questions on there. And the hardest one of all was, is there anything about your life that the governor should know before considering you for appointment? And I talked to some old-timers and decided, well, I better do this rigorous honesty crap. And so I wrote in there, I'm a recovered alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years, and I don't share that at the public level, and I hope the governor won't either. Well, it was a flippant answer. It was obviously a flippant answer, but I didn't have any real expectation of ever being appointed. And they sent a commission. They have a three- or four-person commission they send down to interrogate you about your alleged qualifications. And they sent this group of lawyers down, and we had a good conversation. And just before the interview was to end, this lady commissioner said, about this question 33, you say you're a recovered alcoholic in AA for 10 years. How do we know for sure you won't show up drunk some Monday morning if you're put on the bench? And I said, I can't promise you that I won't show up drunk some Monday morning, because when I was promising people that I wouldn't show up drunk, I was showing up drunk. But if I keep doing faithfully what I've been doing for 10 years, there's a reasonable chance that I won't show up drunk. That's as good as I can tell you. I thought, well, that rigorous honesty crap just cost you that job. It didn't. I was appointed in December 31st of 82, and I served there for 12 and a half years. Retired in 95. And it was a tough job. It was a marvelous job. It tested every single bit of my program or anybody else's program around me. And I was there 1 week. I was assigned to juvenile delinquency court. And a kid that I'd been seeing around AA for a year or more, he was doing really well. He's 16 years old. He's doing great. He was sober. And he came up for a probation review. And I thought, what the hell, I'll take him off probation. He's doing fine. So I took him off probation, and he said, can I come up and thank you? I said, sure. He came up to the bench, shook my hand, and said, thanks, Judge. He turned to a courtroom full of people like this, and he said, thanks, Judge. I'll see you at the AA meeting tonight. What do you say to that? I said, so much for anonymity, you know. And the fat was in the fire. You know, I was then known as the dried-out drunk judge in Ventura County. And later on, I became known as the dried-out drunk in Ventura County who will cut slack to alcoholics and addicts. And I don't mind that title at all. I sent an awful lot of people to AA, NA, CA, GA. I even sent a woman to Al-Anon one time. She was making the run for this guy. She was making the run, buying a gallon of wine for him every day, and even she, he was dying of alcoholism. And God, I said, I gotta quit. I gotta stop this some way. So I sent her to Al-Anon. I don't know whatever happened to the case, but you know, I couldn't just watch her killing this poor devil. But you know, it was really funny because being on that side of the bench, I'd spent 20 years as a criminal defense lawyer, so I've been on the other side of that table where you're representing people who are in every kind of trouble you can imagine, and they just want a little slack once in a while. And I've seen some real Nazis on that bench. And so I swore I wasn't going to be a Nazi. I might be a little tough at times, but I wasn't going to be a Nazi. But I've had guys come in, sent a guy to AA, made him go to three meetings a week. He was a terrible, terrible, terrible alcoholic, and he needed AA. I said, you gotta go to three meetings a week and provide written proof of attendance to the probation officer, and I want to see you in here once a month. He comes in after one or two or three months. I forget how many months he was out there, but he had a card with 200 signatures on it. It looked a little suspicious because the card was signed, supposed to be many different meetings he's reporting here, all in the same handwriting, secretaries all in the same handwriting, all with the same pen. And it had a real bad ring of inauthenticity. So I said to him, you went to 200 meetings, is that right? And he said, absolutely. I said, well, did they read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at any of those meetings? He said, every one. And the way he was saying it was just didn't fit together. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, if you can recite one of the 12 steps, any one, I'll take you off probation. Well, there's something in there about God. Yeah. Close but no cigar. And, you know, I was leading a meeting up in Ojai one time, and the leader gets to sign the court cards, naturally. So I was signing the court cards after the meeting, and this guy comes up, and his neck is red all the way to the top of his head. He's pissed. He's really angry. He doesn't want to be at this meeting. And I didn't recognize him. And I said to him, trying to lighten him up a little bit, I said, "Did you get a little nudge from the judge?" And he said, "Yeah, you son of a bitch, you're the one that sent me." So I said, "Well, I'll recognize this signature on your card when you bring it in." Well, it certainly wasn't all fun, I can assure you of that, because I was assigned for 6 years to dependency court, where we deal with abused children. We had 20 or 30 abused children every day to deal with, and our job was not to punish the families. That's not dependency court's function. That's left to the criminal courts. But our job was to fix these families. And it soon became obvious to me that 95% or better of the people that are in dependency court abusing their kids are alcoholics or addicts or both. So the social workers have been sending them to talk therapy, sending them to anger management, exercise, all kinds of crap. And none of it was helping, it didn't seem to me. So I started sending people to AA and NA and CA and a few to GA. And we started seeing some results, because we make them go to a certain number of meetings a week, make them keep a careful, close review, so they came back in frequently, and the consequences were immediate. I'd say to them, you know, if you miss a meeting, you don't have to go to the meetings, this is the deal. If you miss a meeting, you get a weekend in jail. Now, that's not a very fair bargain, believe me. But after you send somebody to jail for two or three weekends in a row, they get the idea that, Jesus, it's easier to go to a meeting for an hour and a half than it is to sit in jail for a weekend. Much easier. And so people started responding to our program. But some of the social workers were incensed that we were breaking up their patterns. Some of them were feeding people to talk therapists, and I'm not opposed to talk therapy. I think if you've been sober a few years, it's a wonderful help to people. But if you're drinking, it's like, you know, me telling the psychiatrist in Beverly Hills that I was having these fantasies and all these wonderful dreams, which were just BS. So it turns out that we were getting a few people sober, you know, and I'm not saying we were getting them sober. They were to the point where they were desperate enough, a little helped along by our gentle ministrations, to want to get sober. And I see people all over whenever I talk somewhere. I usually run into somebody whose kids I've taken away from them and given them back to them when they got sober. And that's worth every day that you spend doing that. But after 12 and a half years, I retired from the bench, and Mary and I moved up to Santa Barbara. We lived in Ojai for 27 years, and she worked at Cottage Hospital for a couple more years, and then she retired. And now we live in Santa Barbara, and we have quite a bit of time, and we spend a lot of it working in AA. She sponsors quite a few people. I sponsor quite a few people, and we get to talk every now and then in meetings and conferences, and, you know, it's the best life I've ever had. I've got to be sure to tell you that I have taken all 12 of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the most important thing that I could say up here. And as the result of taking those steps, I've had a spiritual awakening. I hasten to add that the spiritual awakening that I've had is not of the Bill Wilson hot flash variety, although I'd like to have had one of those. I've always been a little jealous of Bill, you know. He has this illuminating experience, and his life is suddenly transformed, and he's walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And that ain't the way it happened to me. I got sober, and I looked around, and my life was screwed, you know. And that's how a lot of us feel when we get sober, because we can't take the edge off anymore. I don't take any little pills to take the edge off or to ease me over the rough spots. And so you got to feel whatever's coming down. But, you know, I don't know any other way to do it, because if I take any of those little pills, I'm going to cut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. It's just that simple for me. And I'm not practicing pharmacology. I don't know anything about pharmacology, but I know from my own spirit, my own experience, that when I was taking those little blue tablets, I was numb in every direction you can be numb in. And so I've had this very slow, educational variety of spiritual experience that's described in Appendix 2 of the Big Book. And as a result of that, I found a higher power in AA that I didn't dream it was possible to have. When I came in here, I had a higher power that I'd been impressed with as a child. And my higher power for 18 and a half years after I got sober was an angry old white guy in the sky. And this angry old white guy in the sky would drop you into a pool of everlasting fire for some damn small infractions. Now, I'm sounding a little bit like a criminal defense lawyer now. But for some really, what we would call infractions in the law. That's less than an ounce of marijuana. You know, you could go to hell forever and ever and ever. And they had the hell scared out of me, you know. And it was very hard for me to think about turning my will and my life over to an angry old guy in the sky that was just looking for a way to zap me. So after 18 and a half years, I had to let go of that old idea of God, because that's all it was an old idea of God. It wasn't God. It was an old idea of God. And that was a marvelous day. It was worth all of the travail that went before it for 18 and a half years just to get rid of that old God. And today I have a very nebulous, vague kind of higher power that would be looked down upon, I'm sure, by certain people who have a very specific higher power with a picture of them in their wallet. I don't have that. And I'm not critical of them. It's okay if you've got a picture of God in your wallet. That's terrific. But this higher power I describe simply as the healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. The healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've learned it by watching you guys for all these years. You know, I've seen you come back to life. I've seen the dead rise, literally, from this program. And families reunited, kids come home, strife, you know, healed. Every conceivable kind of problem you can imagine straightened out through Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I mean by the healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to finish this talk by one quick thing that popped into my mind. I thought when I leave here, I'm probably going to go back to Santa Barbara, and people will say, you know, there was a hell of a speaker down there on Thursday night. I'm not going to say a word. I'm not going to say his name was Ralph White for sure. I'm just going to hand him the program. I'm not telling any lies. I'm just making the information available to them. But I'd like to invite the blessing of the higher power that I've found in AA on all of us tonight. Thanks.
Hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.